If you were to think about taking your child, your grandchild, into a classroom or just sitting them down at a table and putting these four books across the table, one of those books is actually now being actively promoted in many classrooms, and that's the Quran. Believe it or not, in literature books, our kids are learning surahs out of the Quran. Even in things like history books, our kids are getting a pretty good dose of it. Now, if you think about it for just a moment, if we were to look at this from a historical perspective, for many, many decades, Americans didn't really care. We'd heard about it, but the reality was we didn't know anything about it. And then we start looking at a progression, starting all the way back in 1979. Most of you remember 1979, the Iran-Contra, the Iran hostage situation. What a lot of you may not realize, the name of that leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini, that is actually an Islamic name. And by that I mean he is an Islamic leader. That was in 1979. Let's watch a progression. We go from 1979 to 1983 when we've got a bombing on the Marine barracks in Beirut. Again, we ask the question, who took credit for this bombing? Militant Islam. We move forward a little bit further, 1988, where we've got the Pan Am flight going to New York that was bombed over Lockerbie, Scotland. Again, I ask the question, who took credit for this? That would be Islam. We move even closer to us, to the year 2000, when the USS Cole got bombed. And all along, we were getting little glimpses of what was going on, but I think everybody in this room recognizes 9/11 changed everything. Here we are, we're sitting at the 10th anniversary, literally in just a few days. 9/11 caused us to quite literally stop and take pause and ask ourselves, who are these people? And what are they doing? Suddenly, a nation that had kind of been asleep, we wanted some answers. We wanted to know, for instance, what was motivating these people to do such a horrendous thing. We wanted to know what is that word jihad that we're hearing on the news? What about this? Are the Muslims here in San Angelo, are they the same as the ones maybe in Afghanistan? All of these questions began to pop up. And we realized this religion is a lot bigger than we first thought. Their numbers put them in the billions. In fact, unless things change dramatically, they will overtake loosely defined Christianity in about 6 years as the world's largest religion. But we're asking questions like, is it really a peaceful religion? Is Allah the same as our God? What I want us to do is I want us to look at some of the answers to these questions. And I want to give you a little bit of background. And I'll state right up front, I understand some of you know probably a lot more about Islam than I do. And I appreciate that, and I welcome your comments. But I also know that some of you may be on the other end of the spectrum and not know a whole lot. So we're gonna lay a foundation of what is this religion. We're going to talk some about what is their beliefs, how they treat women. Because it didn't take long after 9/11 for the entire landscape of America quite literally to change. You think about what happened in 2007 when we had a congressman sworn into office putting their hand not on a Bible, but on the Quran. Now, folks, if you don't think that this is sitting on our doorstep, it's here. You look at a textbook that was adopted by the state of California just a few weeks after 9/11. It's a textbook called Across the Centuries. It has been adopted. It is now being actively used. In that textbook, the students are forced to engage in Muslim rituals such as praying to Allah, fasting in the Islamic month of Ramadan. In fact, during this period, the students were told, you and your classmates will become Muslim. and I think everybody here has probably heard about them wanting to build a mosque at Ground Zero. So here's what I see as I travel all over the nation. I hear this clamoring of what really is the truth. I mean, are they really a peaceful religion? Is this just a few radicals that don't understand their religion? You got all these different questions. My aim this morning is hopefully to answer some of these questions. Because you see, all of the bombings, they didn't stop with 9/11, did they? We've got, for instance, the Madrid train bombings, the bombings that happened over in London, and they continue on and on. So let's start with a few facts. Facts number one, almost 42 nations are basically completely Islamic. If you look on the screen, you'll notice Northern Africa, Saudi Arabia, most of what we would have referred to as the Middle East. And when I say almost completely Islamic, that means anywhere from 95% and above. This map gives you a little bit better definition. So you've got a situation where everything that is blue represents an Islam nation, most of which are under what's called Sharia law. It's their form of government. You look at the light green areas, that represents nations that are 50 to 90% Islamic. And then you look, for instance, at the yellow, and that would be the direction that it's growing. Now, as I mentioned, there are billions of them today. And there are loads right here in this state. Where did it start? How did it start? We go all the way back to 570 A.D. 570 A.D., a young boy is born. His name is Muhammad. Lives in a little town called Mecca. We know from history that his father died before birth. His mom died when he was just 6 years of age. So this young boy, Muhammad, was raised by his grandparents. Mecca, if we were to put it on a map, if you look at the country of Saudi Arabia, which is right here, Mecca is right up against the coast. Why is that a big deal? That's a big deal because Mecca was very vital in trade routes. Muhammad, being a young man, he would have been very, very familiar with the trade caravans that went through that town. Warring nomads. Now, here's an interesting thing a lot of people don't know about Mecca. It had a religious center. And that was one of the few places where you could actually find peace, calmness, because people weren't fighting in that little religious center. During his early life, he was employed by a rich widow. This rich widow wanted him to manage her caravans, so basically Muhammad starts going up and down the routes between, for instance, what we would call the Holy Lands, all the way down to Africa. So here you've got a situation where this area is occupied by warring nomads. Now let's hit a pause button, because we're 570, now we're up to about 600 A.D. Where is Christianity? We know, obviously, that the church has started. It started on the day of Pentecost. Peter preaching the first sermon. But Christianity hadn't made it that far down yet. So you got Christianity spreading through Asia, through Europe. Jewish communities were still prominent. They played a key role in commerce and trade. But here's part of the problem. There were Jews and Christians in Arabia too, but the Christians didn't translate the Bible into Arabic until after 700 A.D. Why is that a big deal? If you don't have God's Word, the people can't learn. Now, let me remind you. Muhammad is born 570 A.D. Bible's not translated into Arabic until 700. That leaves, quite literally, this perfect void for him to jump in and fill. And he does. Muhammad is a young man. He learns from his parents and from his grandparents. He would have watched them worship pagan gods. All kind, multiplicity of gods. And it was on those trade routes that he actually started to hear the stories of Old and New Testament from the Bible. He would bump into Jews along the trade route. He would bump into Christians along the trade route. And they began to share with him, for instance, about Abraham and Sarah. And they shared with him about Noah and the flood. That's important. Because this is the guy who weaved in enough Bible into the Quran to sound like he kind of knew what was going on. Although he got a lot of details wrong. He married the rich widow. Now, she was much, much older. She basically pulled him off of a life on the road. And it wasn't too long after that that he then went into a cave and allegedly had an enlightenment. And by that I mean, allegedly, Muhammad claims that the angel Gabriel came to him. And he received instruction. So, we got a situation where either this guy was a prophet, or he was a phony. Now, folks, I'm not going to be ugly, but I'm certainly not going to mince words either. My Bible tells me that I've got everything I need. I don't need additional stuff. And it also tells me that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He is the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father except through Him. I don't need somebody coming along 700 or 600 years later telling me, oh, Jesus, he was just a prophet. I'm the real McCoy now. You need to listen to me. Well, that's what Muhammad did. So he goes to this worship center in the middle of Mecca. And this is actually a picture of it. You can see literally thousands of people gathered around together. And he causes all kinds of problems. He tells them he's been visited by this angel Gabriel and that they're wrong because they're worshiping multiple gods. Now, the one piece of credit that everybody in this room ought to at least give him is he did believe there was only one God. Monotheism. He was very quickly invited to leave Mecca. Because after all, he was disturbing the one place in that city that was calm, that was somewhat of a refuge. So they kicked him out. They sent him to a place called Medina. So if you look on the map, here is Mecca right along the sea. He goes north, and that's where he started Islam. And folks, listen to me. There is not a historian who is honest that will deny the fact that he started it with a sword. He would go out onto these trading caravans, and basically, they had one of two options. They would convert, or they would die by the sword. Now, I don't know about you, but if somebody's holding a knife to your throat, that's going to be awfully tempting unless you have a true religious belief. So, he starts his belief system. Traders, they became profitable for non-Muslims to convert for business purposes. All of a sudden, it was kind of like you paid the mafia, so to speak, to be able to use that particular highway. His armies began to grow. They got very adept at desert fighting. The religion was growing. By about 630 AD, they had grown large enough to actually go back to Mecca. He now had enough fighters. He had enough believers to turn that religion, to go back to where he wanted to be in the first place, to his home, to Mecca. And he took over. And in fact, today, literally today, this religious center is the area where they pilgrim every single year. So here we've got the stage set. We're roughly 630 AD. It started. It is in Medina. It is in Mecca. And now it's going to start spreading out. Muslims believe that the Quran was revealed from God to Muhammad through the angel Gabriel somewhere between 610 and 632 AD. Now, let me throw out another thing that most people don't know. He gets back to Mecca, and he died just a couple of short years later. I mean, this was one of the quickest religions to be started and the founder die that's ever existed. The interesting thing, he never ever appointed anybody to be the rightful next heir, so to speak. If I were to ask everybody in this room, how many of you have heard of Sunnis and how many of you have heard of Shiites? Probably most everybody, right? Those two divisions go right back to this. And let me explain. There is a group of individuals who have a strict view of it that in order to be the Islamic leader, you must be a direct lineage from Muhammad. And then you've got the Sunnis. I may have gotten these backwards. The Sunnis actually, I think, are the ones that believe you've got to be directly related. The Shiites are the ones that say, no, as long as you are an Islamic leader, as long as you've learned a lot, basically anybody can be. So you've got the Islam religion itself now fractioning because Muhammad did not say, here's who I want to replace me. Now, let's turn our attention to these questions. What is the religion really like? For instance, how does it treat women? To me, this is one of the most least talked about topics in the news media. And why they do not pick up on this, I don't know. I don't understand why they're getting a free pass and why Christianity is so absolutely criticized all throughout the media. When you look at the Quran, now please understand, I'm going to give you word for word verses. And in many cases, these have actually been taken out of multiple copies. So I've kind of compared to make sure I'm accurately translating. It says, do not force slave girls into prostitution in order that you may enrich yourselves. Now, that sounds interesting for multiple reasons. Number one, it allows them to have what? Slave girls. But you look at it and you say, okay, at least they're saying don't force them into prostitution. Keep reading. If they, the slave girls, wish to preserve their chastity. Okay. Now that sounds good until you read the rest of that particular surah. That goes on to say, if anyone, talking about a slave owner, compels a chastity-seeking slave girl, God will be forgiving and merciful to them. All right, so let me get this straight. We're not supposed to compel them into prostitution, but if we do, it's okay because God is going to forgive us. Yeah. When you look at this religion and the way that it treats women, we go all the way back to the founder himself, Muhammad. After he was expelled from Mecca, an admirer, a man who was wanting to join this religious cult, he brought his 6-year-old daughter for Muhammad to marry. Now, folks, I can say a lot of things right here, but I'll leave it at this. I've got a 6-year-old princess. There is not a way in the world I'm going to give my little princess to any man. So he's already married to this older, rich widow. And now he's got a 6-year-old. For obvious reasons, tradition claims that he didn't consummate the marriage with this 6-year-old girl until she was 9. I could say things about that, but I won't. So he began to add wives after this young lady. Now, I recognize, and I think everybody in this room recognizes, that the Bible has individuals who had multiple wives. But I want to point out, God never gave his stamp of approval on it, did he? In fact, he made very clear, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, 1 Timothy chapter 3, that was not the plan. The plan from the beginning, one man, one woman for life. So where does Muhammad get his defense for allowing this? Basically, he wrote it into the Quran. In fact, I want you to read word for word how he defends the practice of himself having multiple wives. He says, Prophet, we, talking about God, have made lawful for you the wives to whom you have granted dowries and the slave girls whom God has given you as booty. This privilege is yours alone, being granted to no other believer. Uh-oh. There we go. We grant you this privilege so that none may blame you. You may take to your bed any of them you please. Well, that's pretty convenient for the founder of religion, isn't it? But it doesn't stop there. This is a religion that actually promotes concubines. In their holy word. It says, save with the wives and slave girls, for these are lawful for them. In fact, Muhammad himself, in talking about marriage, men who were tempted, he said to marry other women, 2, 3, or 4 of them. Notice he never says just marry one, does he? He starts at 2. And yet we look at the Bible. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4. Marriage is honorable among all, but the bed undefiled. Fornicators and adulterers God will judge. So let's back up for just a minute. He tells them you can marry 2, 3, or 4. In nations that have passed this Sharia law, you remember most of the blue areas that I showed you? It is legal for Islamic men to have up to 4 wives. Now, let's stop right here for just a moment. You want to talk about a recruiting tool for young males? You tell a young man, hey, if you join our religion, you can have 4 wives. By the way, if you believe that Christianity stuff, you can't. In fact, we're going to probably persecute you. So the reality of it is, in places that have already passed Sharia law, Islamic men can have 4 wives. How did all of this kind of come about? So you got Muhammad who's got multiple wives. Obviously, the guys around him aren't going to put up with that for long. So here's how he entices them. As they're out there taking over those slave caravans, he tells them, any of the women and children that we get, you can keep. We're going to go take over this slave caravan of 50, 70 people, and any of the women, the daughters, you can have for yourselves. You can put them into slavery. And in fact, those who really understand this religion understand it is a religion where women are treated quite literally as property. If you look, Sudan was still practicing slavery through Islam all the way back to 1991. And most people who study this religion, they will tell you, in northern Africa, it is still going on, folks. So, again, let me ask this question. Please understand, I'm not somebody who promotes feminism at all. In fact, I kind of run the other way. Because somebody please tell me why in America we haven't jumped on this, realizing this is a religion that absolutely diminishes and ridicules and humiliates women. So how do we get to that point? Here's what he did. He promises them along the way, you can have all of the women and slave girls. But then some of them started wondering. They started saying, wait a second. What happens if we die and we don't get to enjoy those women? And that's when he made a claim. A claim that almost everybody in this room has heard. And that is, if you die in service to Allah, you're going to have virgins waiting on you. Now, folks, let's think about this for just a moment. The reality of Islam is they have turned heaven into a brothel. It's not about God. It's about the women. And, folks, that is a perversion in every way that you want to look at it. Now, I'm throwing this in there just because I know right now there's at least 1 or 2 guys in here wondering, okay, how do you get around the problem of, okay, let's say they get 40 virgins. You go to heaven. Well, if you're there for 5 or 10 years, to put it tactfully, they're not. So how do we get around that problem? Well, that's okay because Muhammad thought about that as well, telling us that he has created a rare creation. We have made them ever virgins. So now you've got a religion that is based quite literally around sex. You're bringing men into this religion with the promise of sex. So we got a problem. The problem is the men of this religion don't want other guys looking after their wives and daughters. So what did they start doing? They started covering them up. They started putting very thick clothing on them. These guys didn't want their wives, their daughters, to become objects of sexual desire. So Muhammad realized this was a good thing. We will cover up our own ladies. And he began to write it into the Quran. O Prophet, say to your wives and to your daughters, to the women of the faithful, to draw their outer garments close around themselves, that it is better that they will be recognized and not annoyed. God is ever forgiving and gentle. In fact, in another portion of the Quran, it says, say to the faithful women to lower their gazes, to guard their private parts, not to display the beauty except what is apparent of it, and to the extent of their head coverings, to cover their bosoms. You see, in this particular religion, it requires women to be veiled. In areas that have this adopted Sharia law, even journalists that go over there nowadays, in most cases, they have to put on something. Not only that, a woman is seen to be as Satan when a man is sexually tempted. One of the traditions of Muhammad is that the majority of people going to hell are, in fact, women. Most of you in here know that one of the widespread practices is they actually will circumcise females when Sharia law is passed. So again, let me point out something to you. This is a religion that quite literally turns the concept of heaven into a brothel. Now, another important thing to note, and this is something I don't want anybody in here to forget. I didn't realize this until my study. The only way that you can know that you're heaven bound, if you are in the Islam religion, is if you die in service to Allah. This is a very works-based religion. Why is that a big deal? It's a big deal because in San Angelo, Texas, when we think about somebody strapping a bomb to themselves and walking into a pizza parlor, we think, they're nuts. They don't think they're nuts. They think they just literally guaranteed themselves an entrance into heaven. And as such, their entire religion, you can't see the word right here, their entire religion is based on this word of jihad. And yet, everybody in this room, I hope you are very familiar with 1 John chapter 5, verse 13. Look very carefully at what the Bible says. These things I have written to you who believe in the name of the Son of God, that you may know that you have eternal life. Folks, we don't have to strap a bomb to ourselves to know that we have eternal lives. We can know it this morning. So now we've got a religion that says in order to please Allah, you know what you've got to do? You've got to die in service to Allah. Now, I'm going to go ahead and make this claim, and now I'm going to back it up. We are hearing over and over and over that this is a peaceful religion. And I'll grant you, there are probably some Muslims in America who, deep down, they don't necessarily want any kind of major war, or they don't want to kill you. But you need to understand, at the crux of this religion, their desire is not peace. Their desire is world dominance. When you open their holy book, it says, He it is who sent His messenger that He may cause it, that is Islam, to prevail over all religions. Actually, I had one of them tell me, to my face, this was a gentleman who was converted out of Islam. He said, Brad, he said, Americans are foolish. I said, why is that? He said, because we're building mosques all over the place under the guise that either they are cultural centers or that this is a peaceful religion. He said, it will be peaceful. He said, 10 or 15 years, it will be peaceful. But he said, eventually the day is going to come where they're wanting to grow and expand. And he said, the peace won't be there. So, think about it for just a moment. Let's look at this kind of from a compare and contrast. You've got one that was started by the blood of Christ, you've got one that is started by the blood of jihad. If we were to compare and contrast Christianity with Islam, Christianity began and spread through evangelism, Islam began and spread through violence. Salvation under Christianity is promised to those who obey the gospel. Islam guarantees paradise to martyrs who fight for their cause. How about this one? Christianity is a religion of the grace of God. Islam is the religion of the works to Allah. Sometimes I'm asked the question, you know, is their Allah the same as our God? A lot of people would say yes, I would say no. Because if you read their book and you understand who their God is, he doesn't look at all like Jehovah. This is a works-based God. If you think about it for just a moment, they actually say in one of their holy books, "Then as for him whose measure of good deeds is heavy, he shall have a pleasant life in paradise. But as for him whose measure of good deeds is light, his abode shall be in the abyss of hell." What are you saying, Brad? I'm saying that in order for this religion, for you to get a good spot in heaven, you got to do a lot of work. Is that the case in Christianity? Can we work ourselves to heaven? Folks, it's all about the blood of Jesus Christ and the grace of God. So let's get back for just a second to this idea. Are these a peaceful, believing people? I'm going to show you a couple of surahs out of their Quran. And I'm not even really going to comment on them other than I want you to read them. And then I want you to ask yourselves, somebody that says this is a peaceful religion, are they ignorant of their own beliefs or are they just lying to us? Because here's what it says. "But when the forbidden months are past, then fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them. Seize them, beleaguer them, lie in wait for them in every stratagem of war." Another one says, "Kill them, unbelievers, wherever you find them. Fight with them until there is no persecution. And religion should be only for Allah." Now, having said all of that, and again, I'm not here to preach politics, but folks, it bothers me greatly that we've now got Islam individuals in our Department of Homeland Security. We'll talk about the wolves guarding the hen house. When you look at a compare and contrast of this religion, you got the Bible versus the Quran. Are they the same? Absolutely not. You've got Jesus versus Muhammad. Are they anywhere close to the same? No. In fact, I would point out, Jesus Christ told Peter, "Put your sword away." We got God versus Allah. Are they the same? We've got evangelism versus jihad. Are they the same? No. All right. What are their beliefs? What are their actual practices? Let me share with you very quickly the pillars of Islam, and then I'll open it up for your questions. There's actually six or five, depending on how you look at it. They have a creed that all Islam, or Islamic folks, Muslims, must adhere to. They have five daily prayers that I'm sure you all are at least somewhat familiar with, that they get down, prostrate on the ground. They usually roll out a carpet after washing their hands, going through a routine. They have almsgiving. They have fasting during the Islamic month of Ramadan, and they have a pilgrimage to Mecca. That is, one of the goals of all these believers is to one day get over to that place in Mecca. And then lastly, jihad, or holy war, in defense of Islam. Anybody that is considered an infidel is considered a target of that. The first pillar is that you believe in one God and one God alone, and that is Allah. You believe that Muhammad is Allah's prophet. Now, stop right there. Anybody in this room that doesn't believe that, you are by definition an infidel. Number two, they're to pray five times a day, at specific times of day, facing towards Mecca. And so a lot of times you will hear in various places, like Dearborn, Michigan, where they've really kind of taken over, they actually now have loudspeakers, call to prayer. Every single prayer begins with them reciting the opening chapter of the Quran. I'll put it up here just so you can kind of see. So they start out chanting this passage. "In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, and praise belongs to God, the Lord of all being, the all-merciful, the all-compassionate." And if you ever heard them, it sounds like a chant. And that's basically what it is. As I mentioned, they've got to wash their hands in a prescribed way before they pray. They're formal, they're memorized prayers. Now, their day of worship is actually on Fridays. Why is that a big deal? If you've ever traveled overseas, the day when they have raised the travel warning is almost always on Fridays. Why is that a big deal? Because you've got a lot of Muslims going into these mosques and they get fired up. They get passionate about service to Allah. And then they walk outside and they see somebody from San Angelo, Texas with a Nikon camera around their neck. And they recognize that's not one of us. And so usually it's Friday that is the day that you actually get the travel warnings. Third pillar is almsgiving. Very hard to nail them down on how much they give. We've tried several different ways, and I've read and seen things anywhere from 5 to 15%. Basically, this is their idea of giving back. The fourth is they fast during the Islamic month of Ramadan. Ramadan being the month or the time that the Quran actually came down to Muhammad. So during that month, they don't eat. They're not supposed to from sun up to sundown. As I mentioned, the last pillar or the fifth pillar is when they gather at this place. And all these little white spots, these are actually all people, literally millions of them, pilgrimaging to Mecca. Comments, questions, thoughts? I realize I just threw a lot of material at you in a very short amount of time, but I wanted to at least give you all an introduction to this. I think it's important. I think we need to know, because our kids are certainly get exposed to it whether they realize it or not. Comments, questions, thoughts? Yes, sir. Okay, and that's a great question. Why have they appealed to the black folks in our nation? A couple of reasons. Number one, they are kind of coming in under this guise of we're the downtrodden, we're the, you know, slavery, beaten down, civil rights group. We're the minority. And that has appealed to quite a few of them. The bigger answer is they have one of the biggest prison ministries in the nation. And again, I'm not trying to be racist and say that prisons are only for black individuals, but the statistics bear out that there's a huge population of African Americans in prison, and they are converting a lot of them, a lot more, a lot better than we are. Good question. Other comments? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. They just passed it in Britain. Yep. He said anytime there's enough of them, they want to be ruled by Sharia law. They actually just passed it in Britain. Here's the scary thing. 3,000 women had filed for divorce in Britain from their husband. Now, these are women who of the Muslim faith. The day they passed Sharia law, for those who believe in Islam, the very day, all 3,000 of them dropped their divorce request. That ought to tell you a little something. Yes, sir. Say that again. Yes. Absolutely. Right. Okay. So they're not going to take their stuff to Salvation Army. Or Goodwill, or... Say that again? Yes? Oh, they also get a horse with the women. White horse. Any other comments, questions before I've got about six or eight more slides I do want to show you in that, in talking about, okay, what do we do? Yes, sir. You know,
Yeah.
They are Muslim. Oh, wow. That's an important point. Because if they can put that phrase in a textbook and have our kids recite it, that's huge. Spoke to a gentleman. He actually is an NFL linebacker. Converted out of Islam. And he looked me square in the face. He said, "Yeah, Brad, my dad's supposed to kill me." He said, "If I go home, my dad is, by law, supposed to kill me because I've left the faith." What do we do? Number one, we've got to use the truth. We have the truth. And don't ever forget that we have the truth. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. I think what it's going to take is it's going to take people like us learning just enough to be able to have an intelligent conversation with our friends and our neighbors. Ask them, you know, why does your holy book say X, Y, Z? Why does your holy book allow you to have four wives? Or why? Then we've got to take this information to our neighbors, to our coworkers. I tell you guys, I'm not here to preach politics, but it's time we hold our elected officials responsible. Because I think we need to understand it may not be warring from without. It may be warring from within. What about immigration? You know, every person that comes into this country, if you're applying for U.S. citizenship, you have to say, if asked by the government, are you willing to bear arms for defense of the United States? Every single person. And yet, as we've already talked about, guess what? They apply their oath to Sharia, to Islam. So, you know, this may seem radical, and I'm sure the press would call me politically intolerant. Not that I'm worried. But maybe it's time that the Immigration Department actually say, will you deny Sharia law in the United States of America? Because that's asking them, are you going to put us above that? And folks, it's kind of getting to that point. Let me sneak ahead just a little bit. Interestingly, our Constitution guarantees equal rights before both sexes. If you look at all of our founding documents, men are created equal, nor that any person be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. The Gettysburg Address talks about that all men are created equal. And yet the Quran equates one man's testimony to that of two women. So if let's say a lady in this room is being abused by her husband, if this was an Islamic mosque, in order for her to even open her mouth, she's got to have somebody with her. And even then, those two ladies only equate one male. We've got to get more active in prisons because they have done a tremendous job there. We got to preach it from the pulpit so that folks understand what the truth is all about. Because ultimately, John chapter 14, verse 6 is still very, very valid today. I'm the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father except through me.